Well, tonight we're going to continue our discussion about hope. I'm glad you're here. And tonight we're going to talk specifically about how to have hope when life doesn't go according to plan. And I felt like after 2020, whose life went according to plan? And then probably you could still say now, whose life has gone according to plan? Something that is certainly the case in our lives that I think all of us have the tendency when we were young to have a general vision of the way we thought life would go. I think when you're a teenager, you have some kind of semblance of that. You know, maybe you were going to get married, have a house with a white picket fence, 2.5 kids, and all of that kind of thing. And you'd be, the, you know, just what the American culture and the American dream says you're going to have. And so often it can be the case that the way we perceive life to go isn't going to be the way it's going to go. There are a lot of people in the scriptures that we could probably look at as individuals whose lives did not go according to plan. But I submit to you that perhaps one of the people in scriptures whose lives really did not go according to plan is Joseph. When you think about the life of Joseph, and our text is going to be really from Genesis 37 to the end, don't worry, I'm not going to go line by line in that, and to put a disclaimer on it, I am doing a great injustice to Joseph to take 14 chapters and go rapidly in 30 minutes as fast I can about his life. There are amazing messages and amazing things that are found in each of those details given in the life of Joseph, but I want to quickly sketch his life and think about what he goes through and how his life does not go according to what he would have thought life would be like and how he was able to handle that. You have in Genesis chapter 37, as the scene opens up for us, that immediately it's not long that life begins to unravel for Joseph. He's 17 years old. All of his brothers hate him. Not only do they hate him, it's because of the favoritism of his father. And it gets to such a point that after Joseph is seeing these dreams that indicate that his whole family is going to bow down at some point before him, the brothers come up with an idea to say, you know what we're going to do? We are going to kill him. We are so done with him that what we're going to do is just get rid of this dreamer. We don't want him in our lives anymore. And as that plan is unfolding, interestingly, Reuben says, let's not kill him. Let's just stick him in a pit here for a while and let him stew on it there for a few minutes. And while Reuben is away, you have then this plan that turns from conspiring to kill Joseph to Judah standing up and saying, well, let's just go ahead and sell him. I mean, a dead brother is not very valuable, but we could sell him and get an awful lot out of him. And it just so happens as these Midianite, Ishmaelite traders are coming by, they are able to sell Joseph into slavery, and he is then sent down into Egypt. The brothers put some blood on his coat, take it to the father, and just simply say, is this your son's? Implying he got killed by an animal, and that's what Jacob believes. I don't know that anybody's plan at 17 years old would be that your brothers will hate you to such an extent that they want to kill you but decide to make money off of you and then ship you off into slavery into Egypt. As the story unfolds, you sometimes come to Genesis 38, and have you ever read Genesis 38 and wondered, why in the world is this here? All of a sudden we have this story about Judah. But chapter 38 is a really important part of the story because you need to know that Judah is a terrible person. That is proven in chapter 37. It's his idea to sell Joseph into slavery. He's the one that comes up with that plan and executes that plan. Chapter 38 needs to tell you he is a wretched individual. He is a terrible person. He's involved in prostitutes. He's not a good guy by any means. But that comes back into play later on as that unfolds in Joseph's life. And if you think about life and as it unravels and things don't necessarily go according to plan, how many times have you said these words about your life, that things just went from bad to worse? How many times has life just seemed to go from bad to worse? If it wasn't bad enough for Joseph to have all of these things happen to him and be sold into slavery, and you think about those things, who from the outside would not look at that and say, you know what, I don't think God is with Joseph. I mean, his brothers hate him. They almost kill him. And now here is Joseph as a slave in Egypt. But you'll notice in chapter 39 in verse 2, it makes it clear the Lord was still with him. It's an important statement that's made as this begins to unfold in Joseph's life. Even though these bad things are happening to Joseph, it says in verse 2, the Lord was with him. Now that becomes hard to believe because the next thing that happens to Joseph is here he is a handsome man, he's working hard for a man named Potiphar. Potiphar's wife takes a fancy to Joseph and says day after day after day, come lie with me. Joseph refuses day after day after day until finally Potiphar's wife becomes so aggressive about it that she then grabs the cloak of him and tears and says, come lie with me. And Joseph runs out to get away from that situation, by which then Potiphar's wife declares that he attempted to rape her, and the only reason she survived is because she had called out. And I just want you to think about Joseph's life, that after this claim, if it wasn't bad enough that your family seems to hate you, and you've been sold into slavery, a false accusation of rape now lands you in prison. And now you are in an Egyptian prison where the Pharaoh at that time throws all of his bad people. And the outsider would look at that scene and go, well, now clearly God is not with Joseph. I mean, look at all the bad things that's happening to him. But notice verse 21. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. No one would look at these circumstances and go, well, I can clearly see the hand of God, and God is right there with him. It looks like life is falling apart for Joseph at this moment. But then as the scene continues to unfold in Joseph's life, here he is in the prison. He becomes favored to the prison keeper at that time. And it just so happens that the Pharaoh at that time becomes disgruntled with this chief cupbearer and chief baker and sends them into prison. And both of these men at this time have dreams, and by the hand of God, Joseph is able to interpret their dreams. The chief cupbearer has a dream, and by which the dream indicated that given in 3 days, you will be returned back to your position. You'll be back at the right hand of Pharaoh, and you're going to be the one who is tasting that drink and making sure it's safe. The chief baker, who sees the favorable interpretation of the dream, asks Joseph to also interpret his dream, and he says, in 3 days, your head is going to be taken off of your body. Not quite with the interpretation he was looking for, but what is so interesting in this is Joseph then tells the cupbearer, when you go back to Pharaoh's presence, remember me. Remember me and tell him about me being down here. The 3 days go by. Just as the interpretation said, the chief baker is executed and the chief cupbearer returns to the presence of Pharaoh. And I want us to realize that this would have been Joseph's great hope to get out of prison. And imagine this hope that it stands before you, that after all of these bad things that have happened to you, that you have a family that doesn't care, you have brothers that hate you, you've been sold into slavery, you have been falsely accused of rape, you've been thrown into the prison now, and now here is what appears to be your one chance to get out of this mess. And you tell that cupbearer, please remember me when you go back. And a day goes by, and a week goes by, and a few more weeks go by, and some months go by, and we're told toward the end of chapter 40, he was forgotten. The chief cupbearer forgot all about Joseph. And I want you to imagine how his hope would have been dashed as weeks turned to months and months turned to years. Chapter 41 and verse 1 tells us 2 years go by. 2 more years go by in the dungeon. 2 more years in the prison. And you can imagine how hopeful you would have been during the first week, which would have waned a little into the second week. And by a year, you got to figure, this isn't going to happen. And year two goes by. This is clearly a hopeless situation. It doesn't look like I'm going to be rescued. It doesn't look like anything's going to change. It doesn't look like anything could be helpful or better. There is not a light at the end of the tunnel. And something amazing happens as the rest of Joseph's life is given to us in these pictures. That it just so happens in chapter 41 that Pharaoh has a dream. And when Pharaoh has the dream, the cupbearer goes, oh yeah. Oh yeah, there's a guy down there in prison these past 2 years who's able to interpret dreams. You should get him. And you can imagine as they go and get Joseph out of the prison, clean him all up, prepare him to go before the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh asks if you're able to interpret the dreams. And Joseph says, it's by the power of God that I'm able to interpret these dreams. And he's able to explain to Pharaoh through the dream that there's going to be this 7 years of plenty, economic prosperity. But after that, it's going to be a severe 7-year famine that is going to go on. And now Joseph becomes elevated to being second in charge over all of Egypt. The wording is clear. There is no one greater in Egypt except Pharaoh himself. What a reversal that has taken place. That he has gone from the hatred of the brothers, them wanting to kill him, sold into slavery, falsely accused, forgotten in the prison, and now he's essentially the prime minister of Egypt. He is number two. And it's important to capture where Joseph is in his thinking at this moment. We are told that at this point he is 30 years old. Now please think about that. He's now 30. 13 years of his life have been lost. 13 years of his life have seemed to be wasted. 13 years that we usually call the prime of life, from 17 to 30 years old, have been completely taken from him. He's 30 years old. He marries the daughter of an Egyptian priest, pagan priest, the priestess of On, marries an Egyptian. And I want you to notice the naming of the children because it gives you a frame of reference for how Joseph is thinking at this moment. The first child they name is Manasseh. And he says, here's what that means. God has made me forget all of my hardships and all of my father's house. You catch what Joseph's saying? Forget my family. Manasseh, God has made me forget my family and all of my pain that they have inflicted on me. God has brought me here and made me forget all of that misery. Forget my family. Forget Dan. Forget the brothers and the second son, Ephraim. God has blessed me here in this land of affliction. This is where I belong. This is home. This is family. It is important to get a sense of where Joseph is at because that plays so much into what happens next. When we come into chapter 42, you begin to see something really interesting, because now this famine takes hold over the land, and 10 of his brothers, minus Benjamin, come down into Egypt to buy grain. And we're told that Joseph recognizes the 10, but the 10 do not recognize him. And the first thing Joseph does is he gives him a big hug and says, "It's been so long that I've seen you guys. It's been over 13 years. How are things going?" Watch what happens. We're told in verse 7, he spoke to them roughly, calls his brothers spies, and throws all of them in prison for 3 days. Who of us wouldn't feel kind of good about that move, right? I know who you guys are. You guys are spies. I'm throwing you in jail. And he keeps calling them spies. And it gets to the point, as he's calling them spies again and again, that the brothers start talking to each other. And Reuben says to the brothers, "This is because of what happened to our brother. Did I not tell you to leave him alone, and you didn't do it?" And the brothers, of course, have no idea that Joseph speaks Hebrew as they stand before this Egyptian. And Joseph hears for the first time, Reuben tried to save his life. So Joseph then says, "Here's how you can prove that you're not spies. I'm going to let you go back with the grain. But to come back, you need to bring your youngest. You've told me the story about there being 11 brothers and one that's died. There's only 10 of you here. When you come back next time, bring him also." And what Joseph does next is he doesn't imprison the oldest, Reuben, because he just found out Reuben tried to help him. He goes for the second, Simeon. And think about it, he puts Simeon in prison until the brothers return. This isn't, "Hey, Simeon, we got a lot of catching up to do." He keeps him in prison. And by the way, that's not for a few days. As the text continues to tell us this story, the brothers go back with all the grain. It's not until all of that food and grain are gone, however long that took, months upon months upon months, as they're eating this food, that Jacob says, "You all need to go back to Egypt and get food." And the brothers say, "Listen, here's what the guy down there told us. If we go back, we have to bring the youngest with us." And Jacob, because that's the final child of Rachel, is very resistant, but finally says, "Okay, we're going to die here of the famine if we don't." And so the brothers, leaving Simeon down there all that time, now make their way back down to Egypt. They come with Benjamin, Joseph sees them, allows them to buy grain, and this is not still some happy reunion yet. Joseph has another plan. His plan is very simple. He tells a servant, as they're packing up all the grain, to stick his silver cup in the sack of the youngest, in Benjamin's sack, and let them go a distance, and once they go a distance, I want you to call them to come back to me. And so off they go, and then the servant runs after him and says, "One of you has stolen the silver cup. After all the good that we have done for you, one of you has stolen the cup." They all say, "There's no way that's happened." They all come back to Egypt, and they all begin to open their bags one by one, and lo and behold, when they finally open Benjamin's bag, there's the silver cup. And Joseph's message, if you carefully notice it, is, only he needs to stay. What do you think Joseph expects these brothers to do but to abandon him just like they abandoned Joseph? This is the plan. He believes they clearly will hate Benjamin just like they hated him. And so slip the cup in the bag, have him stay in Egypt. Joseph and Benjamin can live happily ever after. But something shocking happens. Of all the people, Judah steps up and says, "You can't take him. You can't take him. It'll kill my father. You take me instead and let him go." And if you notice the text, that's when Joseph breaks. That's when he breaks and he reveals himself to his brothers and tells them, "I'm Joseph, the one that you sold into slavery. I'm the one." He finally gets that this amazing scene that just finally melts his heart in all of this. And you can imagine that the brothers are just dismayed. Now just imagine, the guy that you thought you basically had killed because you sent him off into slavery, you are now standing in front of him, and he is the second most powerful man. And your lives are now in his hands. Joseph can do whatever he wants to do to these brothers at this moment. Whatever. The Egyptians are not going to care. You could have dispatched with the other 10, kept Benjamin, lived happily ever after. The Egyptians wouldn't have cared. And Joseph says, "Is my dad alive?" And they go, "Yeah." He says, "You go back and get him and you bring him down here. And I'm going to take care of you guys through this famine." You get to chapter 49, dad dies, and the fear is renewed. Here's what the brothers say in chapter 50. "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'It may be that Joseph will hate us, pay us back for all the evil that we did to him.'" They kind of think that the only reason Joseph is doing any kindness is because of Jacob, his dad. And now this is the opportunity to finally deal with him. They can now receive the revenge of Joseph. And this is the focal point that I want you to listen to, how Joseph responds to this. Joseph said to them, "Do not fear. For am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." And please zero in on the last line. "Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them." Here's my question. How was Joseph able to comfort the brothers, speak kindly to them, and even say, "I'm going to provide for you and your family and your children going forward," after all that these brothers had done to him? How they had ruined his life, had taken his life trajectory of how he thought things were going to go and completely dashed them into pieces. How is Joseph able to do that? And I believe there are three pictures that are given here by Joseph, two of them in this very text. The first thing that Joseph says is, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God?" Let that settle in on you for a moment, because Joseph has the power and the ability to do whatever he wants to with Joseph. And what he says is, "Am I in the place of God?" Essentially, his understanding is that we do not have the right to use our power to punish or to use the power of our anger, or to use our vengeance on someone else. He has the power. And he says, "I'm not in the place of God." The reason why this is, I think, so important is because this is a principle that the Apostle Paul seizes on. We are not to repay other people evil for evil. Now, here's the loophole, right? That's right. We do not repay evil for evil unless they do. You know, if they do some pretty terrible stuff to me, then, you know, it's okay for me to vindicate myself, have some vengeance, try to avenge myself, punish them. And I do hope you'll think about anger for a minute, that I will submit to you that 99.99999 with a line on top of it percent of the time, our anger comes from this. I am going to punish you for what you've done to me. I am going to make you pay for wronging me. You didn't do what I want. You didn't do what I like. You didn't do something right. I'm going to use my anger to punish you. That is the most common way we try to punish people. That's the most common way we try to right these wrongs. And of any opportunity here to think that Joseph could do anything, and he goes, here's what I understand now at this moment. I am not in the place of God. I have no right to do that, even though I could do anything to you, and the brothers fear it. That's not for me to do. Do not repay evil for evil, even if your brothers hate you, sell you into slavery, and cause you to have your life completely changed, thrown upside down, and ruined. Don't repay evil for evil. That is so important for us to remember. When life doesn't go according to plan, people can do an awful lot of bad things to us. People can hurt us tremendously. But it's not for us to bring about our punishment, our wrath, our anger, our judgment, our vengeance upon them. We are to leave that in the hands of God. And it's so easy for us because we feel right, and we may be right, that we were wronged. By the way, was Joseph wronged? Anybody want to say, no, he's overreacting. No, he was wronged, completely wronged. But he understands. Number one, I'm not in the place of God. I'm going to leave that to God. Number two, notice what he says in the rest of that to his brothers. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. And I hope you'll let those words just sink in for a minute. As for you, you meant it for evil. Now think about that. Notice Joseph keeps culpability on the brothers. The brothers still did evil. What they did was wrong. We're not erasing that and saying, well, it really wasn't a sin. No, it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. What you did was evil. But here's where hope starts coming in. God meant it for good. And what he says here, I think, is very transforming because it reminds us that just because your life is not going to plan does not mean that it's not going according to God's plan. And that's hard. But Joseph just said, just because things didn't go according to the way I think they should have gone, doesn't mean God wasn't at work. And just because things are not going the way I thought my life would be, doesn't mean that it's not going according to God's plan. Listen to how Joseph said that point earlier to the brothers. When he reveals himself in chapter 45, he comes to them and says, come near to me, please. Chapter 45, verse 4. And they came to him and said, He said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into slavery. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. Notice culpability. You did wrong. For God sent me. The light bulb is coming on now for Joseph. Before, he's trying to punish his brothers. He's throwing them in prison. He's calling them spies. He's trying to keep Benjamin here. And the light bulb comes on and he just says, God sent me here before you to preserve your life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there will be 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, that to keep you alive for you, that many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. For it was not you who sent me here, but God. The big takeaway I want you to think about of what you see in the life of Joseph is that God is able to take evil, take circumstances that do not go according to plan, and use them for his good. And here's the great thing. Here's the way God wanted to prove that truth to you. The cross. Humans meant it for evil. God meant it for good. God has the extraordinary power to take the evil things that people do and still be accomplishing his purposes and still have his will be done and still do what he intends. And that then reminds us then that God is still with us, and whatever you are going through in this moment, that God is there. When you read the life of Joseph, there is nowhere in there where you're saying, oh, certainly God was clearly there as he got sold into slavery, while his brothers hated. God is with you in the darkness. God is with you at that time when life is not going according to plan, when things are falling apart. Here is Joseph now understanding that God was still accomplishing his will in Joseph's life, even though it looked like there was no way that was happening. And that is a place for our hope. Because just because life isn't going according to plan doesn't mean it's not going according to God's plan. And you think about all the things that you and I experience in life and how many things go wrong, how many times we are wronged, how many times we are hurt, we experience loss, we experience pain. And it is so easy to step back and say, clearly God hates me. God's not with me. God does not care. God does not love. What is going on? God is asleep at the wheel. What is happening up there? Why doesn't he do something? This isn't right. And so when you're in those dark moments, I want you to come to the life of Joseph. And he didn't see it for years and years and years. And then finally he hit that moment where he realized God was still at work, that God had not left him, that God had not forsaken him, that God still loved him. And in that moment, he could still accomplish his purposes. I wish I had time. If I had 30 more minutes, I'd tell you the various circumstances of my own life, struggles, pains, issues. Some of you out here know my life and you know the roller coaster. And this is a powerful thing to know, that even when life completely falls apart, God is still working through his plan. He's still working in your life. He's still accomplishing his will. And just because it didn't go according to your plan doesn't mean it's not going according to God's plan. Let's go to God in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for giving us this kind of hope because life just does not go right. And so many things happen that, Lord, we do not understand. And we experience so much that we do not comprehend. And Lord, it can feel like we are in the dark. We can feel so empty. We can feel so lost. God, I pray that you would lift us up in those times of darkness and remind us of your love, to remind us of your servant Joseph, and help us to see that it's not for us to execute our wrath when people harm us, but it's our time to trust you. And Lord, help us to do it, that you would strengthen our faith, that you would encourage our hearts, and help us to realize that you can accomplish your plan through the most unusual, the most amazing, and even the most evil of circumstances, that your will would be done. Lord, thank you for your Son that proves it to us. In the greatest event of wickedness, of the death of your Son, you used it for our glory, and we thank you and praise you for it. In Jesus' name, amen.